This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, military recruiting on college campuses, African-American TV viewing habits, and Denny's still in trouble. Joining us here in our New York studio, John McWhorter, a Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy. In our Chicago bureau, Laura Washington, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and George Curry, the editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. He joins us from Maryland today. Folks, we'll start with the Supreme Court, and they are reviewing a recruiting law. They have decided to consider whether colleges and universities may bar military recruiters from their campuses without fear of losing federal funds. This comes from a review of a lower court's ruling in favor of 25 law schools that restricted recruiters in protest of the Pentagon's policy to exclude openly gay people from military service. We've also seen some colleges suggest because of particularly the student stances with the war that they would want these recruiters barred as well. John, your thought?
Well, I am very much against any kind of discrimination against gay people. It's a medieval kind of bigotry. But there's a certain smell here that I don't like. I wonder how the same people who are so up in arms against the military recruiting because of its gay policies would have a problem, say, with a hip-hopper who has made faggot references in his songs to coming to campus, or, say, Amiri Baraka, who's got some anti-Semitic verses in his poetry, or how you might interpret some of his recent poetry. Somehow I don't think they'd mind those people putting their feet on campus, but it seems that there's this certain anti-military bias. I understand how we might not like what's going on in Iraq, but really, it seems to me that this is a kind of a post-Vietnam, oh, the army is a terrible thing issue, rather than a consistent application of a coherent political position.
That being said, there are and have been some college campuses that have barred a number of rappers based on their lyrics, misogynistic and the like. George Curry?
Not as many as would bar these recruiters.
And certainly not sending it to the Supreme Court. George?
It's not the same thing as just having someone express a point of view as speakers versus coming on your campus. In some cases, open up your career department and welcome them, making them part of career fairs and these kinds of things. And basically, you're going beyond just merely free speech. This is a vexing issue because basically what the law schools are saying, we want to discriminate against the military because they are discriminating. And there are about 25 law schools that want to do that. And, of course, they're citing the earlier case where the Boy Scouts were allowed to do that. And it's not a simple case. And certainly, I think it's going to come down on the question of whether this is a First Amendment issue.
Well, the reality here is that, indeed, there are many anti-war people on campuses. I teach on a college campus myself, but there are many folks who are very supportive of the military. And I think that there's the motivation on the side of the military is that, as we know, recruiting is down. The war is turning a lot of people off, so they're looking for new venues. And in the past, they focused primarily on minorities, and we know that's why minorities are disproportionately represented in the military. But now they're looking for new ground, so there's a lot of pressure coming from the military. I think the thing that concerns me more than anything else is the tone and the message that recruiters bring to these campuses, not just to campuses but also to inner cities, in terms of the rosy promises that young people are made to young people about seeing the world and, you know, wearing a uniform, and obviously they're recruiters, so they're PR people. They're not telling the whole story, the true story about the expectations that people are going to face in the military.
Yet hasn't that always been the case? It just seems to be heightened, obviously,
absolutely,
in wartime.
It's heightened because they are having a hard time finding folks, and so I think the pressure is on to keep those numbers up. Mm-hmm. And the pressure is on also, I think, to attract a better educated recruit, especially in wartime. I think that, you know, the message has gotten out to the lower income folks, minority people in particular, who are going into the military not necessarily for the right reasons. They're going in because they're desperate for financial opportunities. They're running out of those folks, and they have to go to other places.
What is interesting to me is that these are law schools. I mean, how much recruiting do they do at law school? You don't get a whole lot of candidates there. I would have thought that this would have been more on an undergraduate issue, but the fact that these are 25 law schools is a particularly interesting twist.
Well, if they can't go to campus, you can assume that there'll be other ways that they'll get to the same people, especially in this internet age. So that's another aspect of the issue.
All right, another interesting point that was brought up this week, this from a conference that was sponsored by American Enterprise Institute, and it actually took a look at philanthropy philanthropy as relates to schools. And it's suggesting that the new benefactors, those that are giving today, are less likely to hand out mega donations, large donations, and let the system take over. Instead, they are insisting that schools improve test scores, in many cases, overhaul basic functions. And there has been some concern that these benefactors may also start to shape curriculum and move into other areas that perhaps I underline, should be left to the schools. Laura, how much does the idea of the mighty dollar come into play here?
Dollar always talks. This is a long-term trend in terms of the school reform movement in general. Obviously, No Child Left Behind. There's been a lot of calling and pressure for more accountability, more responsibility, and I don't see anything wrong with that on its face. I do have a concern, though, about the influence that philanthropy can have. I've seen it here in Chicago. The major foundations here have a lot of influence over government. They're funding a lot of programs that used to be supported by government in terms of rehabilitation of public housing, in terms of school reform, in terms of many other issues. And the dollars talk. The point that has been made, though, is that the amount of money overall that's going from major philanthropy into education is like $1.5 billion annually, and that's small fry as compared with the $400-some billion that comes from government.
George Curry, they're also suggesting that these benefactors are also guiding and rethinking how superintendents and school boards are trained. Oftentimes, these school boards and superintendents are elected by voters within states. How much does this cross a line?
Well, I mean, conservative foundations have been extremely interested in higher education and been giving the money, certainly slanted in that direction. I think this can be a good thing if properly used. I was speaking to the Council on Urban Board of Education boards out in San Diego recently, and what I found out, there were a lot of creative things going on in public education with the HEPA Foundation. For example, in Chattanooga, they matched their best performing teachers with the worst performing schools, and they give the teachers a $5,000 bonus. If the schools advance a certain level, they give them $2,000. If they want to buy a home in the city, they give them a partial of a down payment. There are creative ways that we can improve our public school system, and I think that's where the emphasis ought to be, and I think they can play an important role.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's turn our attention and look at Denny's. Some Arab Americans are suing the franchise. Seven men of Middle Eastern descent have sued Denny's restaurant franchise and one of the managers there for $28 million, saying that they were kicked out because of their ancestry and that they were compared to Osama bin Laden. All of the men were U.S. citizens. All of them. Seven of the men, I suggest, as I suggested before, of Egyptian, Lebanese, Syrian, and Palestinian descent. They included a doctor, a real estate agent, an insurance broker, and a restaurant owner. John McWhorter, this certainly, if nothing else, tells where we are today.
Yeah, we're at an intermediate point, and the lunkhead manager who did this should be tarred in public, and thankfully he is being so. And there seems to be a certain bizarre pattern of this with Denny's over the past 10 years. I find it hard to believe that Denny's is actually actively recruiting racists into its ranks or asking their applicants whether or not they're racist. But these things are going to keep happening, and people who do this sort of thing ought to be revealed as what they are. But then on the other hand, as far as the rest of us, whether we be Arab or whether we be black or Latino, I hope that we'll take the advice of James Weldon Johnson, keep our heads high, and realize that racism can't destroy our self-image. Well, but this man is an idiot.
Laura, we should note that this happened in Florida and is specifically to that particular restaurant, though it is owned by Denny's. And Denny's says certainly if these gentlemen choose, could be sought in the lawsuit. How much do you believe that this should be looked at as an individual incident as opposed to, as John has already suggested, just continuing problems for the Denny's franchise?
Well, when I heard about the story, I thought, here we go again. You know, Denny's has become the icon for discrimination when it comes to the issue of public accommodations. It's a wonder that they have any business left at all. But that having been said, you know, because Denny's has become so high profile, you've got to wonder about this case sounds pretty egregious, but you've got to wonder about some of the cases in this litigious society that get brought against public places where folks, you know, maybe got mistreated, but maybe isn't necessarily a discriminatory issue.
Oh my goodness, are we allowed to say that? Go ahead.
We are. But that also says that racism is alive and well. And I think that, you know, when you're talking about basic public accommodations and when people are still going into restaurants, going into bars, going into clubs. I know, George, you've written about this in terms of the clubs in New Orleans and being mistreated because of their race. That tells you how much further we still have to go.
Now, I'm going to surprise all of you with this. I'm going to actually defend Dennis. Not this one, of course. But they have been egregious, outrageous in the past. But that's a company, if you go back and look at their record since then, they have made some tremendous improvements. So I don't think it's fair just to say this is Dennis across the board. I think this is definitely an incident. I don't think the management of Dennis condoned this. But this was so egregious. We're talking about U.S. citizen and somebody coming out saying Bin Laden is the manager in the kitchen, or we don't serve Bin Laden here, to U.S. citizen. I think they should get the certainly the most harsh punishment we can think of. And it's not just merely an allegation. The Florida Commission on Human Rights did an investigation and said there's reasonable cause to believe that their charges are accurate.
Right, George, I wouldn't make a distinction about whether or not someone's a U.S. citizen. No one deserves to be treated like this, whether they're a recent immigrant or not. And I think this is representative of the backlash against Arab Americans or Arab immigrants or what have you that has occurred since 2001. And it's something we need to be really need to be cognizant of.
But that, no, I agree with you, Laura. I don't think it should be doing. I mean, you shouldn't, whether you're a U.S. citizen or not. I totally agree with you. But I think it's particularly egregious, as we put the Japanese in internment camps, when you're dealing with U.S. citizens and people having these stereotypes when they're actually probably been here longer than some of them.
Yeah, truly. And that was the point I was going to make, George, oftentimes, and we still see it today, depending on how you look. There's an ignorance in this country that just presupposes you can't be a citizen of this country if you look like that. All right, turning our attention now to a study that looked at black television viewing and the habits of blacks, and the Scarborough Research suggests that African Americans and Hispanics watch more television than the general population, and blacks in particular watch 70% more soap operas and 22% more science fiction programming. I don't know if that means anything, but the idea that coupled with what was recently brought out at the RTNDA, and that is executives of television that get together, suggesting that blacks still do not have positions that allow them to green light and formulate what is on television, yet we disproportionately watch it. Let's take a look at what many see as problematic, and that's the disproportionate amount of time African-Americans spend in front of television, John McWhorter. And then on the other side, if we're going to spend that much time, shouldn't we have some say in what's on?
Well, there is a certain problem with how much television African Americans watch, given that it has been shown in the occasional study to impact scholarly performance. But on the other hand, if what we're saying in complaining that there aren't enough black people behind the scenes is, and I think this is the implication, that this impacts what is seen in terms of the diversity among black people on the screen, I think that making that charge in 2005 is like getting up and making a speech saying we need to put fluoride in the water. You have to admit when a battle has been won. If you think that nowadays black people on TV are disproportionately criminals or maids or hip-hoppers or whatever you think it is, then basically you're someone who, for one reason or another, doesn't watch much TV. It's no longer 1980.
You don't think that to be the
not
case?
Not remotely. If you look at all of the black shows that are on television, or if you just look at the commercials, it's at the point where it's not true that the middle class black experience, that the working class black experience, that the professionals, as well as people who are poor, etc., is not on the screen. If somebody came and looked at black TV now from 1955, they would be baffled as to what there is to complain about. Now, talk about behind the scenes. Yes, there's still work to be done, although remember that in terms of the black representation of the population, we're looking for us to be, say, 1 in 8, not half. So we're on our way there.
First of all, I totally disagree with that. I mean, certainly I think the black middle class is more representative, but you still got a better chance. Let me finish. Hold on. You still got a better chance of getting on TV if you're a buffoon, if you're playing a stereotypical role, if you're a person of color. And study after study show that. Now, I agree that we spend far too much time watching TV, and I really note when they show these Hollywood stars and BET has us look inside their homes and closet, that you can always see TV screens and in great music system, and I rarely, in fact, I can't think of a single time when I look at these celebrity homes that I see a book or bookcases. And I think that's something that does need to be addressed.
Well, just look at the news. Putting entertainment aside, the news is supposed to reflect reality in society. And if you look at local news and national news, you see the same stereotypical images, if it bleeds, it leads, negative images of African Americans. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind. It's not just the entertainment.
Isn't that true of how the news reflects the whole country? Isn't that the general complaint, that the news is shallow and sensationalistic? Because if it is, then naturally black people as members of the nation are going to be brought into the same net.
They're way overrepresented when it comes to local news in particular, in terms of, you just look at any of the 15 minutes of any local news broadcast.
So what should they be showing instead of what they show?
They should be showing a much more balanced reflection of the community, of dare I say it, positive things that are going on in the community. But I think the whole issue of who's behind the news is important. And it's not just, I think we've come a long way in terms of having visible people either on the news or in entertainment shows on television, but especially among the middle class. But if you look behind the camera, the producers, the decision makers, Richard Parsons is the head of Time Warner, but he's not making decisions about what goes on CNN every day. It's the key producers. And if you look at the ranks there, we have a long way to go.
I should note that I meant to say that it was NAPTE, the National Association of Television Program Executives, at their recent national conference, that all of this was discussed. And it is interesting to note how even the prism here is seen differently. I don't think, John, many would argue that image of African Americans, particularly the middle class image, is far better than it was 20, 25 years ago. But I would still contend that for the most part, outside of the one or two black shows, quote, that are on, most of the images and most of the images in terms of mainstream programming that you see African Americans in are either a sub role or a hoodlum, frankly, still today.
Ed, I genuinely don't know what you mean. For example, there are a lot more than one or two black shows now, and they regularly depict a middle-class world. Right, and, of course, a sitcom is a sitcom, but that's a race-neutral concept.
All right. Well, I tell you what. You and I will watch TV together, and I'll point out
we should try that.
The little hoodlums in the background that always seem to be African-American, but we'll see what happens. John McWhorter, Laura Washington, and George Curry, thank you all very much for joining us. Greatly appreciate it.